Scientists say they've discovered one reason why overweight people eat more than they need to and find it so hard to stop. Their report comes out tomorrow in the journal Science. And their research involves high-tech brain scans, fancy genetic tests, and some chocolate milkshakes. And we've got some milkshakes, too, in this story from NPR's Richard Knox.
You could say we're all addicted to food. But we all know some foods are more addictive than others, like the milkshakes that a worker is whipping up at Gifford's Ice Cream in downtown Washington.
Make sure it gets all the ice cream all blended up.
Today, one of the customers, Yvitra Jordan, is rewarding herself with a sundae. Chocolate milkshakes also make her happy.
Warm and fuzzy, and, you know, I just feel good. I'm like, ooh, that was great.
There's very few things that excite the brain as much as chocolate.
Eric Stice of the Oregon Research Institute says chocolate is just the thing to investigate the brain's reward system, the circuits that light up when people eat or drink something tasty. And chocolate milkshakes are ideal. The yummy flavor can be squirted through a straw while volunteers' heads are clamped into an MRI scanner. Stice and his colleagues looked at how the brains of 77 young women responded to the milkshakes. Some women were lean, some obese, and some had a gene that makes them less sensitive to dopamine, a chemical central to the pleasure response. So they don't get as much pleasure out of food as others.
When obese individuals eat food, they seem to have a blunted response to this food, and if you're at genetic risk, this effect is amplified.
We're used to thinking that overweight people love to eat and get more pleasure out of rich treats like ice cream. The Oregon researchers say this notion is only half true.
If you look at the brain response to when people are about to get the milkshake, obese individuals show greater activation of reward circuitry, not less. So ironically, they expect more reward but seem to experience less.
Kent Berridge of the University of Michigan says the new research helps explain the biological difference between wanting and liking. By wanting, he means anticipating something delicious. Liking means the pleasure that comes from actually tasting it.
It's an exciting result. The wanting and the liking start to come apart. The wanting is up and the liking might be blunted. And it's very intriguing that the blunting might happen in some individuals with a particular gene.
As with other addictions, Stice thinks people overeat to compensate for the mismatch between the strong cravings they have and the reduced enjoyment they get. The best way to avoid this vicious cycle is to develop healthy eating habits before pleasure responses get blunted by overeating.
Don't get your body used to eating high-fat, high-sugar foods because it'll be really hard to stop.
It's best to do this when you're young, Stice says. If you're already obese, the new research may have other implications.
So if you're trying not to eat chocolate, eating just a little bit of chocolate every day is not going to be the way to go. It's better to stop eating chocolate and say, that's the healthy improvement I'm going to make to my diet. And after a month, maybe 6 weeks, your craving for chocolate will finally go down and stay down.
Yvitra Jordan ponders the new research over her sundae.
I think that a lot of times what you see and what you think may fill you up, you know, is not necessarily what your body really needs. I think medically some people just can't get past it. I'm a mind over matter type of girl.
If the Oregon researchers are right, that's truer than she realizes. Overeating has a lot to do with what's going on in the mind. Richard Knox, NPR News.
You are definitely not ready for this. Thanksgiving. We'll explain why we're talking about Thanksgiving in a moment.
First, a reminder about how we have embraced this meal in the past.
It wouldn't be Thanksgiving if it wasn't chaotic.
When it comes to cranberry sauce...
It isn't Thanksgiving if you don't hear that sound.
I love that noise.
Stupid idea of the recipe was this.
Here's the breastbone.
All right, here we go.
And don't be, you know, go ahead, let us have it.
Just
okay,
is that good enough?
Yeah, I think.
I'm kind of
put
enjoying
that down.
This. I want to do this some more. Chris Kimball has been our guide for Thanksgiving cooking and chaos over the years. He's host of the public television program America's Test Kitchen, and he publishes Cook's Illustrated magazine.
We're getting him on the line a little early this time around. Hello, Chris.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. We're here because we want to explain what we're planning this year for our Thanksgiving.
Well, it's easy. This year, we're not headed towards chaos. We're going to plan ahead. And so we're asking listeners to send us their questions ahead of time, And so if your turkey always turns out dry, well, hey, we'll help you find a way to make it come out juicy.
Or if people don't have the right equipment for whatever it is they're dreaming of cooking for Thanksgiving, maybe?
We can do that. Get you the right equipment, right pans, right knife, right timer.
Or deal with not having the right equipment, getting around it. I suppose we can improvise, couldn't we, Chris?
The best cooks never blame their tools, Steve, right?
No, that's what I'm going to be doing on Thanksgiving. But send us your questions at our website, npr.org/food.
And here's the thing. We're going to share some of the answers next month before the big day. But, you know, Chris, remember last year with the homemade ice cream?
Oh, I remember that. Well, we stood on the porch for an hour and listened to it go round and round until finally got done. About half an hour later than I thought it would.
Oh, well, that sounds very rustic.
What, you mean the ice cream or the ice cream maker?
Or maybe rusty, I don't know, something like that.
It was rusty too, yeah.
Well, let's be a little bit less rustic this year. Would you like to come to my kitchen in my home to try this again?
I would love to. This time I can trash your kitchen, not mine.
Okay, we'll look forward to that in Washington, D.C. on Thanksgiving week.
All right, guys.
Take it easy.
Okay, yeah. See you next month.
Bye.
For Kitchen Window, I'm Bonnie Wolf. Susie Chang is a New England-based freelance writer and reviews cookbooks for the Boston Globe. She has written a piece on fall soups for NPR's Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Bonnie.
So you are a transplanted New Yorker who's finding yourself in the cold wilds of New England. Is this how you got interested in making soups earlier and earlier in the year?
It's true. I start thinking about it in, you know, early September, the second that you get the first hint of cold in the air. But fall soups are just this wonderful solution in so many ways. It's a one-pot meal. It warms you up. It's cheap. It's filling. It feeds a crowd, and it freezes. So you can not only feed a crowd, but you can feed one person for a week very easily.
What pantry staples do you need to have if you want to whip up a soup at the last minute?
Well, that's the great thing about fall soup. You really don't need much. It's probably the easiest soup you can make. You always have onions, celery, carrots, garlic in the house, most likely. If you have those, you can probably make fall soup.
What is your feeling about homemade versus store-bought broth?
Oh, you know what? I don't think it matters a great deal. If you're the kind of person who makes broth, that's great. You know, use it. It'll taste great. But you can even use water as long as you season it properly, use a little salt and pepper. You know, this is really like making stone soup. You can make it out of anything.
This is wonderful news.
Yes, yes, it is.
Do you freeze soup?
You know, I would, but I make 8 or 10 cups at a time, you know, and it's still gone. If not the first day, it's usually gone the second or third. I eat soups all the time for lunch. In fact, today I'm going to have squash soup for lunch.
What kind of squash do you use in the soup?
I think it's pretty flexible. I like using butternut because it's so easy to use, especially, you know, you can buy it already peeled and chunked up, and that's terrific. But you could use acorn, you could use kabocha, you could use Hubbard, you could use delicata, you can use red curry. I made one with that last night.
And ooh, what did you made a red curry?
Red curry. It's actually it's not curry, but curry.
Curry. How do you spell that?
K-U-R-I. It's this gorgeous flame red bumpy pumpkin, basically, and it's, you know, about the size of your head. And it's just got this gorgeous color. It's beautiful, and it's really tasty.
And do each of the squashes have a slightly different taste?
Oh, probably. But, you know, I just use them interchangeably.
And you don't change seasonings depending on the squash?
You know, I might just for fun, but, you know, I think that the, like, for example, the sugar pumpkin would be a lot sweeter, you know, a cooking pumpkin than using, say, a delicata squash. But so I might go a little more spicy with the sweeter ones, and I might go more buttery and cumin-y and, you know, smoky with the more savory ones.
Do you sort of make them up as you go along?
I do. In fact, the best fall soup I ever made was probably a roasted pumpkin soup I made years and years ago. And of course, you know, I just completely wung it. So I don't have the recipe, and I'll just have to try and make it up again someday.
What was so good about it?
I think it was just the caramelization of the pumpkin and the butteriness and the, I don't know, whatever I use, cumin or lime or something like that. It just had those sweet, mellow, earthy pumpkin flavors. In fact, you know, all soups have these fantastic ingredients that have these lingering dark tastes that just stay with you and fill you up and make you feel warm inside.
What are some of those ingredients? That
well, besides the pumpkins, there's mushrooms, right? And there's bitter greens. I like.
Now, back to mushrooms for a second. Are you talking about wild mushrooms, domesticated mushrooms, a certain kind of mushroom?
The mushroom soup I talk about in my story is based on dried porcini. So it always feels like it's a real treat to me because they're a little bit expensive. But the fact is, mushrooms are great. You can use button mushrooms. You can use crimini. You can use whatever you can get. And I used to be a real wild mushroom snob, but not anymore. Now I realize that, you know, if you cook them correctly, you can get flavor out of just about any mushroom.
And what about dried mushroom versus fresh mushroom?
If you have dried mushrooms, use them because they really amplify the flavor, especially in mushroom soup where chances are you're using water rather than chicken stock. What you do is you soak the dried mushrooms in boiling water, and then you have this wonderful flavored mushroom stock that you can use instead of chicken broth, which gives us a wonderfully light mouthfeel, yet an incredibly dense and smoky and delicious taste.
So actually, dried mushrooms work better for soup.
Well, I like to use a combination, actually. The dried mushrooms for the broth and the flavor, and the fresh mushrooms, which I, you know, actually sauté a little bit first, just for texture and also for flavor.
What is your favorite fall soup?
It might be mushroom soup. I love them all. It's so hard for me to say, but I love any kind of mushroom soup. I like this wild mushroom soup that's in the story. I like cream of mushroom soup. I love cream soups, although I haven't actually mentioned those in this particular piece. But I adore mushrooms, and I can't get enough of them. I'm like a hobbit.
And what else are ingredients that are particularly available in fall, the sort of end of summer?
Oh, yes. Well, you can really get beans, and you can get lentils, bitter greens. And any of those root vegetables, your onions, your celery, your carrots, your garlic, your potatoes, all of them make great soup.
You serve this as a one-pot meal. Do you serve anything else with it?
Well, that's the beautiful thing about it. If you are, you know, we've talked in the past, I know, about what a lazy cook I am. And the thing is that if you make fall soup, you can do it in one pot, and then you can just have, you know, a glass of wine, piece of good bread, and that's a meal. And they're so filling that you really don't need anything else.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
In addition to nutrition and warmth, you seem to have a sort of emotional feeling about soups in the fall.
I think that people should know that not only is soup easy to make, it's one of those things that you can do to make your life a little better, but that you don't usually think of doing, like putting on a pair of warm socks. You know? It's like when it's cold and the trees are bare and, you know, you feel lonely in that kind of basic existential way. Soup is just this wonderful way of filling up the holes.
That's wonderful. Susie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Now we turn to an important matter of state. If John McCain wins the election, what kind of meals will be served at the White House? Last week, we cooked with the owner of one of Barack Obama's favorite restaurants in Chicago. Today, we're going to meet the chef at one of John McCain's regular spots. We sent NPR's Daniel Zwerdling to Annapolis, Maryland, to investigate whether the kind of food a candidate eats reveals something about the man.
John McCain was a Navy pilot, right? He flew off aircraft carriers. Everybody knows that. He trained at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. And when he goes back to visit, he often eats at Pusser's Landing. The manager, Michael Schwartz, says it's not hard to see why. There are huge models of military ships all over the restaurant.
When you walked in, we have a carrier out front. We have the Constitution.
Pusser's restaurant is right on the dock. It overlooks a waterway nicknamed Ego Alley. That's because people parade past the restaurant in their boats. Inside Pusser's, there are life preservers on the walls and replicas of leaping fish. And here's something interesting. Just about everybody on the staff has seen John McCain, because he eats here when he visits his son. In fact, his son's the fourth generation in McCain's family at the Naval Academy. But I couldn't find anybody at Pusser's who's really talked with the senator.
We see him coming in here, having lunch or dinner with his son over in the corner, away from everything. You know, very quiet, very unassuming man.
Have you personally had any interactions with him?
I've had, hello, how are you, welcome to Pussers, but that's it. No conversation outside of just taking care of him. And we respect his privacy and don't really bother him.
The executive chef here is Jim Erickson. He presides over a huge stainless steel kitchen. He says he's proud to cook for people like John McCain, but it doesn't faze him.
You said earlier you don't even know when John McCain is out there eating your food. So who do you cook for? Who's in your mind when you're slaving here over this hot stove?
I cook for myself. My standards are pretty high, I think, and so that's what I go by. It's what I want it to be. But I think mainly I cook to, not for myself to eat, but for myself to be proud. Does that make sense? That's what I try to do. So John McCain is eating what I want him to eat.
Hussar's Restaurant is a living example of globalization. It's in a Marriott hotel in one of the most historic cities in America. And most of Pusser's dishes have a Caribbean theme. Jerk chicken, coconut rum shrimp. And over the next few minutes, Jim Erickson's going to teach you to make his famous Haitian Creole seafood gumbo.
10 years ago, the Chef Association in this area started a competition for gumbo. The first year we came in third place. The next 4 years we came in first place. And then the next 5 years after that, we've gone back and forth between first and second place.
I think a lot of people might be a little bit scared by the thought that they're going to have to make a roux and all that stuff and a shrimp stock. Is this going to be pretty easy for all our listeners to make?
The steps that I have to make this actually pretty much make it impossible to screw up. Let's get started. Well, the first step is we're going to make some shrimp stock, which is the liquid for the gumbo. What I did earlier today is I got 1 pound of large shrimp. I peeled and deveined them, and I saved the tails and the shells. And I'm going to start off by sautéing that with just a little splash of olive oil and then add a little white wine. Let that go for about 5 to 10 minutes.
Wow, that's it? 10 minutes for shrimp stock?
Not a whole lot to it.
Who knew?
Yeah, it's a well-kept secret.
All right, while you're cooking, the first thing I would really love to know is, how the heck did you get the name Pussers? Weird name.
Pussers is a corruption of the word purser. Back in the old British Navy, 350 years ago, the purser was in charge of all the ship's stores and issuing equipment and things like that. And the conscripts for the British Navy couldn't say purser very well, so it came out pusser. So it was the purser's rum, so it became pusser's rum.
If I were lucky enough to be in the British Navy in the 1700s...
That wouldn't be lucky.
How much rum would I get from the purser, from the pusser?
Way back when, you got a half a pint tot twice a day.
Twice a day?
So you got
How'd they sell?
So you got a cup of rum twice a day, and it was 95 proof rum. All right. On to the red pepper.
And Erickson chops a few cups of peppers and celery and onions. In the world of Creole, they're often called the holy trinity of cooking. They're the base of all kinds of dishes.
Now we'll get started on the main part, the gumbo. And the first part of making any gumbo is making the black roux or the chocolate roux, as I like to call it.
And it turns out that making the roux is simple, too. You just melt some butter and add some flour, and you whisk. And you keep whisking for about 10 minutes. This roux will thicken the gumbo and give it that deep, rich look.
We're starting to get a little color, but try to imagine a chocolate bar. That's the color we're going to stop at.
When John McCain made a campaign stop in Annapolis, he held his press conference right outside Hussar's Restaurant. And on the surface, Jim Erickson is the exact kind of voter that McCain is trying to reach. He grew up in a blue-collar neighborhood in Columbus, Ohio. He got his first job in a restaurant when he was 16 years old. He washed dishes.
We are just about there. You can smell the aroma coming off there. It's a very caramelized flavor. Can you smell that?
But Erickson says he was a dishwasher for only a couple months because they kept promoting him to the bread station, the salad station, the fryer station.
And I went back and forth between that and other jobs, but cooking ended up paying better, so I stuck with that, and I've been with it ever since.
Was that really one of the main reasons you stuck with it, because cooking paid better?
That's what got me started with it. This is back in the 70s. Back then, you know, most of your jobs were, you know, $4.50 an hour was a decent wage. So being a cook started to become a pretty good job, like 30% more than I could make at any other kind of jobs.
And what were your friends doing? Like, what did you figure you would do if you weren't being a cook?
Well, back then, two of my best friends in high school ended up going in the Army, and that was never for me. a couple guys joined the fire department and things like that. And there also was a local bus factory pretty close, and actually a lot of my people I went to school with went off to be the factory worker, which again was never anything that I wanted to do.
What did they say to you when you said, I'm going to be a cook?
Not really a whole lot. No one ever was derogatory about that. Being a chef, even back then, it was a good profession to be in, a solid, steady, more of a blue-collar profession, and it always has been because it's a hands-on working type thing. Actually, my mom didn't want me to follow that for cooking as a career. She looked at it as more as I'd be a cook or a scullery worker all my life. My mom passed away quite a while ago, so she never saw me as a successful chef. All right. We are coming up on milk chocolate.
It's interesting you say that cooking was a blue-collar profession, because now with TV, it's really become almost like being a rock star. You don't picture yourself as a rock star.
No. As you can tell by my girlish figure, I'm no stranger to a knife and fork, so I don't think I have the TV profile, so to speak. The jolly fat guy wouldn't make it on the screen. I'm going to go right there, turn that off, grab my vegetables.
Erickson takes the roux off the heat. He dumps in the peppers and onions and celery.
Listen to this. It's really going to fill up that stuff.
And then he stirs in some okra and the stock, some herbs, and sausage.
Now we're also going to add Worcestershire sauce, which was invented in India.
When Pusser's restaurant hired Erickson to be the chef, he had to learn something about the Caribbean. After all, the restaurant's theme is a taste of the real Caribbean. So the company sent him to the British Virgin Islands, mainly to eat. And Erickson says at first, he was kind of disappointed.
Because everybody's recommending, oh, you got to go to this restaurant and this restaurant and do this and do that. So I went to these places, and they were kind of the higher-end type restaurants down there, and they were all trying to be American food. So I found better food at the roadside stands, a little place along the side of the road where everybody's standing up and eating, and more authentic.
And you told me something before we were recording, but you told me something sort of funny. You said the owner of Pusher's went with you to some of these restaurants, but you said he wouldn't be caught dead going to the roadside stalls.
Well, I can't speak for him that he would or he wouldn't, but he never went out with us to the roadside places. And I can't see him going to those places, though. And if you want to put that in, that's fine. I mean, I don't think he'd be angry with that. Radio's not a real way to smell, but this really smells good right now. You have to trust me.
So that means it's finally time to cook the seafood. Erickson sautés some garlic and olive oil, dumps in a big batch of clams and mussels in their shells. He adds scallops and shrimp at the last minute. And finally, he pours on the gumbo.
Let me get a serving bowl here, and we'll show you what our finished product looks like.
It's like a seafood orgy in a bowl, wrapped in a rich sauce, like brown velvet.
All right, that looks pretty darn good right there.
This is why we wanted to interview you, Jim. This is just an excuse to have your gumbo.
I get that a lot.
And now Jim Erickson says something surprising. He's been the chef at Pusher's for 13 years, and he's never even met his famous customer.
But are you aware that when he's here, when John McCain has been here and you've been cooking, did you know that that particular gumbo you were making at that moment was going to feed John McCain? Did that make you nervous?
Usually I find out about that stuff after they're already eating. It's, hey, by the way, John McCain's in the dining room. But I don't change the way I do things knowing that such and such is there or so on and so forth. For me, there's one way to do it, and that's the right way, so everybody gets it the same way.
Incidentally, I asked Jim Erickson if he's going to vote for John McCain for president. He said, probably. Daniel Zwerdling, NPR News.
You can find the recipe for Haitian Creole seafood gumbo and see Chef Jim Erickson in action at our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.